It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk to a co-author of a bill that promotes hemp production here in Wisconsin that's got bipartisan support in the state legislature. First, think about some of the things you love about where you live. Maybe there's a great local park or the county does an annual 4th of July parade. For a lot of towns and cities, chances are part of the reason you have those things is because of a local service club, groups like the Rotary Club or Kiwanis. Service clubs have deep historical roots in a lot of communities, but today a lot of them are struggling to grow their membership and having a hard time bringing younger people on board. Jeff Charles is an associate professor of history at California State University, San Marcos. He's the author of the book Service Clubs in American Society, Rotary, Kiwanis, and Lions. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, for people who haven't been directly involved with these groups or seen their work in action, can you talk a little bit about the original purpose of things like Rotary and Kiwanis?
Sure. I liked your introduction. It's true that those of us who aren't members, probably most of us at this point, might be aware of these clubs, but not really pay much attention and not worry too much if they begin to disappear. But I really think that's a mistake. It says a lot about how our communities are changing. And so the history of these clubs, I find, reflect some of what's happening today in their origins. They emerged at a time, turn of the 20th century, when communities were changing, new businesses were emerging. And the clubs represented an attempt to sort of shore up communities, local business interests, and respond to this changing economy.
And you write in your book that about 100 years ago-ish now, that's when these things, these service clubs in particular, really came into their own. Why was that such a high point?
Well, I'd say three things. One, as I mentioned, the communities were changing dramatically. They were becoming more integrated into a national network with transportation, telegraph, telephone. Business was changing. There were new types of professions, new service businesses like plumbing, electricians. Restaurants were becoming more common. Realtors and financial managers, the brokers were becoming part of local economy. And so you put all those things together, and what the clubs did, starting with Rotary in 1905, was to bring these businessmen together, forming a kind of network that certainly helped individual business interests, because that was always kind of a factor. But also, they worked for shoring up the business community, and they moved quite naturally into service, doing things at first like town beautification, because of this concern about the changing community. Either it was growing rapidly, urbanizing, or in some rural areas, they were losing residents. And so that was also a concern.
That's been a couple few years since you came out with your book, Jeff. But even then, you were writing about a decline in membership, kind of struggles for local chapters and even national organizations of groups like Rotary, Kiwanis, and the others you write about to keep members and to bring in younger people. What did you see driving that?
Right. So at the time that I wrote my book, these groups were still all male. And so our society is changing for the better in terms of a more heterosocial and publicly concerned group of middle class people. And so I think that was beginning to hurt it in terms of the younger generation. There's a certain type of ritual sociability that many people at the time found a little old-fashioned. So there's a generational change there. Now, of course, all of them do admit women, but I still think they're sort of haunted by that generational gap and the perception that the club is for older business people. One other thing that I think is important, though, is in many communities, the kind of local business interest, the locally owned restaurant, the locally owned store, that begins to weaken in various communities. It's replaced by franchises and Walmart. And I just don't think there's the same sort of interest in keeping business local as there used to be in many communities.
Talking to Jeff, talking to Jeff Charles, Associate Professor of History at California State University, San Marcos. He's the author of the book Service Clubs in American Society. We're looking at things like Rotary, Kiwanis, Lions Club, their rise and decline in recent years. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you are or have been a member of this kind of club. Love to hear your perspective. Jeff, we've seen wider trends in American society that seems to suggest that we don't like to join anything, much less these kind of service clubs. Is that part of the story here?
That could be part of the story. Certainly, if you look at present day, you have to look at the impact of the internet and social media. And that's definitely changed our relationship to local communities. And some people have suggested that the kinds of causes that are pushed on those forums are they get people worked up, and you might then get people out for a big protest. You can do it really quickly using the internet, but there's nothing sustained with that kind of contact. There's no institution and organization that you might keep going to. So that could be a factor.
And you said earlier the rise of these was a kind of an effort for people to have this, in a way, connection to place, to the place they were. Have we lost some of that, too? If we're in a suburb that looks like any other suburb or city that looks like any other city, we're connected online. Does it matter to us to be connected to that piece of real estate, the geography we live in?
Yeah, I think that is also very important. Again, where you see the clubs really being strong are, well, Madison is a pretty good example. Their central club is still has quite a large membership. And so Madison is a vibrant, growing city with a recognizable core of businesses. You get out in the suburbs a little further, every house the same. Maybe you don't have that.
Talking to Jeff Charles, Associate Professor of History at California State University, San Marcos. We're talking about service clubs, groups like Lions Club, Kiwanis, Rotary, and why their numbers have declined over the decades and what might come along to reinvigorate them, replace them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you now or have you ever been a member of one of these kinds of service clubs, either one of the big names or a smaller one? If you're in one now, why is it important to you? What kind of work do you do? What are you trying to do to lure younger people? If you are younger people, would you join one of these groups or are you in a different kind of club? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about the role service clubs have played in American life, things like Rotary and Kiwanis, and what comes next for them as many of them struggle with declining enrollment over the years and decades. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are service groups like these still active in your community? Are you a member? What do you think of the role they play in civic life where you live? Or have you checked it out and said, maybe this isn't for me? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to bring in another voice now to talk about what comes next for service clubs. Nikki Green is treasurer for a group called the Baraboo Young Professionals. They're based in Baraboo, if you hadn't guessed. They do things like professional development training and hosting community events, and their members are 40 and under. Nikki, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about Baraboo Young Professionals and how it came to be.
Well, like you said, a young professional is typically someone between the ages of 18 and 40. They either live, work, or go to school in the community. It's not limited to a particular industry or profession. Our group came to be because we had a core group of people who were involved in other service organizations in the community, and we just weren't feeling fulfilled either personally or professionally with what we were getting out of that traditional group. The Young Professionals concept, it's a nationwide organization. We were familiar with it and thought it was a really good fit for some of the initiatives our county was focusing on to attract and retain a younger demographic, and we thought it was a good fit for Baraboo.
And Nikki, if someone joins the Baraboo Young Professionals, what do you do?
We have meetings monthly that focus on networking and professional development. We hold social events. We hold about a half dozen special fundraising events throughout the year. And we really just try to create energy and buzz and entertainment opportunities for that younger demographic living in Baraboo.
And the fundraising events, is that for local community groups or what kind of causes?
We have a scholarship established at Baraboo High School for a graduating senior. For the last school year, we were able to award one scholarship. And then this coming year, because of our special events, we will be able to award two scholarships.
All right. And Nikki, how do you encourage people to get involved in a group like yours, either in Baraboo or wherever they might be?
I would just encourage anyone who's looking to get involved in their community or just feel more connected to the community to seek out groups like this, whether it's a traditional service organization, to bring your own creative energy to it, or an organization like Baraboo Young Professionals or a young professional group in their community. Facebook, social media, websites, that's probably a great first place to start.
Nikki, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Nikki Green, board member of the group Baraboo Young Professionals. I'll bring Jeff Charles back in now. That's got to be a common theme that the traditional service groups have heard that Nikki just said, Jeff, that the younger people check it out and they don't feel like it meets their needs.
Right. It's very interesting because when you hear Nikki Green describe the Young Professionals, sounds to me like early Rotary or Kiwanis or Lions. And the fact that the established organizations are now perceived as being too encrusted by bureaucracy or other requirements is kind of an interesting commentary. But it could, again, just be a generational gap, perhaps. It is true that the average age of these clubs is older, and although they've made efforts to form a young professional club, Rotary has Rotaract and has had for 30 years or so. I guess they haven't quite succeeded in bridging this generational gap.
Let's bring on our callers now. We've got Jennifer on the line with us in Verona. Jennifer, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I was interested to hear about this because I actually belong to a service organization that's primarily made up of women. It's called Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. And it originally started as a Facebook page and people finding each other and deciding that they wanted to do something about gun violence. And what has built out of that? Our 50 chapters, we're in all states. We are all over Wisconsin. We have 13 local groups. And these are women and others, I might add, who come together and work on issues of gun violence prevention, everything from safe storage of firearms to advocating for things like background checks. And we've really become not just a force politically, but we've become kind of an ersatz social group. We watch each other's kids. We take care of each other when somebody is sick. And so even though we have formed around this issue, we serve as a great gateway for people who are new to areas or want to kind of stay involved. You know, we have the recurring suspects, but we have always an influx of interesting new people who come in and are fascinated by this issue and want to help.
Jennifer, thank you so much for calling. And Jeff, at first I thought, well, wait a minute, this is just a political action type group. But she says it evolved into this social support angle, too.
Sure. But Well, with all due respect to that group, and it's a great cause, and I'm happy to hear about it, it is something quite different from the service clubs. The service clubs certainly adopted issues, but they really tried to avoid politics that would disrupt or not be consensual. I mean, they were mostly, or they are mostly conservative business people, of course, but it's kind of interesting. They strove to be apolitical and community-minded. And so what some sociologists have said is that what's replaced these general service organizations that were business class oriented are these more single issue clubs that then provide some of the social and community activities that Rotary used to do.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Jeff Charles from California State University, San Marcos, looking at service clubs in American society. That's the title of his book. They have declined in numbers, things like Rotary, Kiwanis, Lions Club. And we'll go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Waukon, Iowa. Tom, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Tom?
When I was in high school, the Rotary Club would have the different high school people do debates and stuff like that. And so you kind of got a feel for the place, but that was back in the 60s. There's no diversity. And it's not just women that weren't allowed, but there simply was no, nothing other than older gray white guys that were obviously very conservative. And right now, you know, that's just a group that younger people don't want to be involved with.
Tom, thanks for the call. Jeff, the organizations, the international versions were struggling with that perception, I don't know, with that reality?
Yes. And although I am really favorably disposed to these groups, not a member myself, but still appreciate what they've done for communities throughout their history, you have to grant that they were pretty exclusive and restrictive. And it wasn't until the 60s. Actually, Madison's Central Rotary Club didn't have an African-American member until the early 70s, I think. So there is that aspect. Now, in their defense, I think they were aware. One of the reasons they tried to avoid politics is that they were aware that some of their personal things might tear the community apart if they made too big a deal of it. And so I think they tried to avoid these controversial issues. Nonetheless, there's no doubt they were too restrictive.
We're on one more caller. Pat is with us in Waupaca. Pat, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was just asking a question that might have been asked while I was on the call about whether they were racially integrated when they first started. So.
Yeah, that dovetails with what we were just talking about, Jeff. Were these officially segregated or integrated organizations at the outset?
No. They just kind of passed over the issue. But for all, well, they were segregated in that they didn't have the earliest African-American member I could find in any club was in the late 50s. And so it was a segregated club. Now, again, they represented this white business class, but they also were not like the Ku Klux Klan or anything that emerged in the 20s. In fact, one thing that could be said in defense of their restrictiveness, many Rotary Kiwanis clubs were opposed to the local Klan, which was an organization that emerged in the Midwest and the West in the 20s. And they stood against the kind of not just racial policies, but also they were anti-immigrant, and Rotarians and others found this too divisive.
take a, actually we have time for one more caller. Matt is with us in Milwaukee. Matt, hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I just want to say I'm really concerned about the racism toward white males. I'm a white male, you know, and I'm a little bit insulted by that. But I also want to say I think there's nothing wrong with, you know, organizations saying, okay, we're going to be 40 and under, like the previous caller has been saying, or, hey, we're women only, or we're men, white men only, or whatever. Not, I don't think they should discriminate based on color, that's for sure. But I love the idea of the service organizations. I'd like to join one. I've been thinking about joining for a while and trying to investigate which one to join. But it's tough because I just don't have the time to spend on them, you know, because I got
gotcha,
a family.
Matt. I'll jump in because we don't have a lot of time left. I'm not sure about the discrimination against white males happening in this last half hour. But Matt says, likes the idea of the organization, doesn't have the time. Is that a common refrain, Jeff?
That is. And that's why I think you'll find the young professionals, I noticed you mentioned they meet only once a month rather than once a week. And so that might change. I know there are clubs, service clubs, that are moving toward that type of schedule. There are even virtual meetings now in some service clubs. So they're trying to deal with that. Whether that will be enough, I don't know.
Jeff, just a few moments left. All in all, you think we're better off with these groups than without?
Oh, yes. I really think they serve an important function, even as restrictive as they have been or might be, in terms of attachment to the community, pulling the business class into community interest, and providing a lot of very worthwhile projects, both local and national and international. So I'm a defender of the clubs, even though I'm not a member.
Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah. Okay.
That's Jeff Charles with California State University San Marcos. He was with us today to talk about the history of service clubs like Kiwanis and Rotary in the United States and how their numbers have declined over the decades. A bipartisan bill on hemp production has cleared a final hurdle before being scheduled for a vote in Wisconsin's state Senate. The Growing Opportunities Act would make permanent what had been a pilot program for growing hemp here in the state. The Senate's Committee on Agriculture passed that bill unanimously last week. Representative Dave Considine is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 81st Assembly District, which includes Baraboo. He's a co-sponsor of the bill in the Assembly. Representative Considine, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here.
We'll talk about what this bill does.
The Federal Farm Act of 2018 legalized hemp on a federal level, took it off the Class 1 list. That we can transport it state to state as long as we certify that it's industrial hemp. It gave states a year, basically, for us to approve some sort of regulations on our own, so we're in control of our own program. And that's the rush here. If our state doesn't get it done by the end of this year, then we will be responsive to federal guidelines, which I don't think maybe is encouraging as what we'd like to see on a state level.
And so we already had this pilot program going on. In effect, this takes our pilot program and extends it out in the future. Is that right?
Yeah, it takes it into the future, recognizing that this is now a legal crop to be grown nationally and in the state of Wisconsin. It also allows for some interstate commerce to happen and gives the state control of that whole program.
Why is it important for us in Wisconsin to set our course on hemp policies versus letting the feds do that?
Wisconsin's always been has in the past been a leader in hemp production. And in order to maintain that lead, we need to encourage diversity in Wisconsin agriculture, allow farmers to make this investment. Some of it really intense investment and some of it less intense, but because hemp can be grown for a number of different reasons. But especially now in this climate, we have our own testing program on a state level, and I think that's really important not to be responsible to the federal testing program.
And we're testing for things including the absence of THC, right? To
right.
make sure this is hemp and not anything that could be confused right. for marijuana.
Yeah, not the total absence.
Right. There's a threshold.
There's a threshold, you know, 0.3%. Other states have gone to 1%. We struggled with that somewhat in the state of Wisconsin. I think eventually we will get to that. But there's a lot of fear about how to enforce these laws, and I understand that. You just mentioned the state patrol and other law enforcement organizations were not in favor of this bill and opposed it until we made some changes in how they could enforce it.
In our pilot program now, in addition to that testing we just talked about, what are some of the key features of how the state is regulating the growing of hemp?
farmers have to register that they're going to grow it. Producers have to register. It has to be tested. Farmers have 30 can request testing. And the DAT cap has 30 days to get that testing scheduled. And so it's a 60-day window, which is significant for some producers, depending on, but it makes sure that Wisconsin is protected to have quality CBD products made out of hemp that meets the qualifications. The other thing is that it's going to help us start establishing some standards in Wisconsin. I'm glad to see a lot of CBD shops out there right now, but the problem is there's no regulation, and this bill helps DATCAP begin to start setting those criteria.
So that's the Department of Agriculture, Trade, right, and Consumer Protection. Have we seen with the pilot program so far a lot of farmers getting on board here with growing hemp?
We've had massive numbers of farmers. This time it's in the thousands, the number of farmers, and in the hundreds, the number of processors that have registered to do that, to process. Now, some of them are well off the ground. Some of them are still trying to get off the ground. Many of them are smaller people who are not only harvesting the hemp and growing the hemp, they're also processing it themselves. I have a number of those in my district who will process it on their own farm.
Talking to Representative Dave Considine, Democrat from Baraboo, about bipartisan legislation aimed at extending Wisconsin's hemp regulations, not letting the feds set the rules for us in effect. Let's talk about what we're doing with this hemp. You mentioned CBD oil. Is that mostly what Wisconsin producers are getting into, or there's other things that people have been saying for years? There's a fiber that you can do with hemp, and people are eating it too.
Right. There are. I use hemp seed sometimes at home. Costco is selling hemp seed. That's all imported from Canada or from overseas. And that's something we can produce here and produce very well. So it's the seed, it's the CBD oil used in not only cooking, but as ointments, as lip ointments, some of it ingested, topically put on places that are hurting. And it seems to do, it's not a miracle cure, but it does a lot. The hemp oil itself is the highest in omega-3. It's higher than fish oil with none of the heavy metals. So that's pretty exciting, I think. And then you talk about the fibers that we can make bricks with. We have pieces that we can extract that might even help us make plastics that are made out of hemp.
Are we starting to see that secondary development? We're not just growing it. You mentioned we are producing CBD oil. Are we seeing markets start to form, people wanting to take that hemp and use it for the food and fiber at a larger scale so farmers have places to sell this stuff?
We're going to see what happens. One of the other provisions of the bill makes more reliability for farmers, and that they have, it guarantees that they be paid within 7 days by the processor, which is a big change, and it makes it more like a regular commodity. And factory farm, you know, the big industrial farms can't do this. It limits it to some of the smaller farmers, and that's typical of other commodity products as well. But those uses, they are developing. I can't say they're developed, but they are definitely developing. The interest is huge. There are people who have requested to work with Forest Products Laboratory. I don't know if that's going to happen. I know that there are a number of other labs around the state that are privately invested in that are really working hard in developing other products.
Now, one concern I've heard that's come up for new farmers is the difficulty of getting crop insurance in the past, and maybe of getting upfront loans from banks who are not sure if they're ready to deal with this new product yet. Do you see anything on the landscape there?
Well, I just got notification from my Columbia County ASCS office that they were able to insure, that won't help this year's hemp crop, but it's going to help next year's, that they were going to be able to offer some sort of insurance for that like other commodities. I just got that a day or two ago. In regards to banks, banks are working very hard to try to figure out how to come up with a way of doing it because banking regulations, it's still a little iffy how that's back and forth between the marijuana laws and industrial hemp. And so they're a little worried. They're conservative, and they should be, but they want to serve this industry. And I just attended for a short while a big banking convention in Wisconsin Dells. Attorney General Josh Call was there, a number of other people. Secretary Godlewski was there, and talking about how we can encourage banks and help them to make this transition. I think we're going to get there for next year's crop.
I understand we used to grow a lot of hemp here in Wisconsin before it was made illegal. But do our farmers still have the know-how? Do we have that institutional knowledge, the extension services that are going to help farmers be successful if they go into this?
That's developing as well. Mm-hmm. We certainly have that. When I talked to members of the university when we were first introducing the hemp bill 3 or 4 years ago, they still have that equipment and some of the old equipment. It's kind of mothballed, but some of it's still there. You know, and the average age of farmers in this state is getting up into the 60s. So there's a lot of institutional knowledge as well. The difference is that the hemp we're going to grow now is different than what we grew in its heyday. We're not going to be growing we've been growing some. But by and large, the hemp that's been planted in Wisconsin so far is a shorter variety of hemp, 5 to 6 feet tall. It's not the 17 or 18 foot tall plant that we used for the rope on our naval ships in World War II, which is what Wisconsin excelled at. So it's a different hemp crop. But we're going to get there, and some of that knowledge is there.
Getting back to the state legislature side of things now, is there anything else in this bill or maybe things you'd be looking for in the future when it comes to promoting the hemp industry?
I do think we're going to get to the point where other states are experimenting with this, where we're going to allow some exceedance of the 0.3%. We can't do it yet because we're not confident. But we're going to start expanding that. Other states are experimenting with up to 1%.
This is the THC level.
Of the THC level. Because marijuana technically is above 3%. You know, but there's that level in there that we're playing with. The key is going to come in how law enforcement figures out how they can enforce the laws on marijuana without hindering industrial hemp. And I think we're bringing them along slowly. They've made a concession on this, and we made a concession, and I think we'll continue to work together.
With this legislation that led us to give you a call, now it cleared a key Senate committee unanimously, mm-hmm. I believe. Getting a little wonky here, what are the next steps in the Assembly?
The Senate's going to pass it first, I'm fairly certain.
Okay.
Yeah, well, we haven't had a hearing on it in the Assembly, and I think we're letting Senator Teston take the lead. So I suspect the Senate's going to vote on it, and when we're in session in the middle of October, early October, which is when we're going to be back on the floor, I suspect we're going to get it sent to us from the Senate. That's what I think the process is going to be.
We saw, again, bipartisan support in the Senate Agriculture Committee. Do you think that's going to carry through? Is it going to pass the Senate? Is it going to pass the Assembly where you need support from both parties? Probably?
I think so. I think the only hurdle we had was from the law enforcement agencies, and they're at least neutral. They're not saying they're in favor of it, but they have moved to neutral with the concessions we made in the Senate amendment. And that's really productive, and we have so many associations and organizations in the state of Wisconsin that are in support of getting this passed because we need to allow diversity in our agriculture. We're losing farms like crazy.
Representative Considine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dave Considine, who represents Wisconsin's 81st State Assembly District. Been talking about proposed bipartisan legislation that would turn a pilot program for hemp farming in Wisconsin into a permanent program and extend those regulations out into the future. Officials from several state agencies are raising the alarm over the large number of accidents happening on Wisconsin roadways because of people driving the wrong way down highways. In 2018, there were 500 wrong-way driver incidents recorded in the state. These crashes can be especially deadly given the head-on nature of the crashes. Lieutenant Nathan Clark is with the Wisconsin State Patrol. He's executive officer in charge of the Traffic Management Center. Lieutenant Clark, welcome to Central Time.
It's a pleasure.
So an epidemic, I'm hearing, of wrong way driving. What kind of things are we seeing out there on the streets?
Well, you know, when we talk about epidemic, I think it's just the term being widespread. It's something that we really hadn't studied before. It came to our attention in Milwaukee County when we started looking at the numbers on the interstate system there. And then in 2017, 2018, we started tracking the numbers throughout the state of Wisconsin and found it was a lot higher than we expected for the number of wrong-way drivers on these divided highways.
Right. This is divided highways in particular, not just, you know, that one-way street where somebody gets confused because they're from out of town. We're actually seeing people on highways going the wrong way?
Yeah, that's correct. This isn't just the wrong way driver that crosses over the center line and has that type of collision. This is people entering a controlled access highway, utilizing the exit ramps and traveling the wrong way on a divided highway, generally causing fairly significant crashes if they do crash.
All right, this sounds incredibly dangerous. Do we know what's leading people to make this really dangerous mistake?
Sure. About 86% of the violations that we've been able to apprehend for wrong-way drivers in Milwaukee County have been either intoxicated or impaired by some other drug.
So that's the lion's share of the cause here, it sounds like.
That is definitely the lion's share. I mean, there has been some confused motorists out there, especially towards our elderly population at night, that have, you know, inadvertently got onto the exit ramp when they were placed in close proximity to the entrance ramp. But generally, as to use your language, the lion's share of these individuals are intoxicated or impaired.
And do we know what time of day these incidents usually happen, at least based on the ones you've been able to apprehend?
Again, using Milwaukee County statistics right now, generally most of those violations are occurring between 10 p.m. and 3 a.m.
So I'm guessing this means somebody's leaving a bar or some other drinking location and getting out on the road, it sounds like?
That is correct.
What kind of things, Lieutenant Clark, from an enforcement standpoint, are you working on to try to prevent this kind of wrong-way driving?
Well, one of the big things that we did, again, was starting to compile data statewide. So we started this initiative on January 1st of 2018 by asking all law enforcement agencies throughout the state of Wisconsin to give us a call down here at the Traffic Management Center in Milwaukee and let us know about these wrong-way driver incidents that are being reported to the local jurisdictions throughout the state. From there, we're using predictive analytics to kind of identify hotspot locations where, from not only an enforcement perspective but also an engineering perspective, we can look at these locations where motorists are entering the interstate system or the U.S. highway system the wrong way and make corrective actions, whether it's from an enforcement saturation type patrol initiative or whether we look at an engineering model and re-engineer those exit and entrance ramps or utilize technology like the BlinkLink system that not only will notify motorists that they're entering the interstate the wrong way and hopefully get them to self-correct, but also alert law enforcement and the Traffic Management Center so we can get law enforcement agencies out there to interdict the motorists and also warn motorists appropriately that are heading in the right direction, that a wrong-way driver has been detected in the area and that they should be prepared to take evasive action.
Wow, I don't think I've ever seen that before. How common is that in Wisconsin?
We only have 20 of them in place. They're all in place in Milwaukee County right now. We started in 2012 with six or seven detectors, and we've been installing more and more each year as we've identified these hotspot locations where we're seeing a predominant amount of motorists entering the system. And as I said, now January 1st of 2018, we've been collecting data from around the state and are looking at some of these hotspot areas in Brown County, Dane County, with the possibility of being able to put that technology in place in other systems. Again, with the intention of having motorists self-correct before they enter the main line of the highway system.
Talking to Lieutenant Nathan Clark with the Wisconsin State Patrol, looking at wrong-way driving on Wisconsin's divided highways and efforts to stop it. Lieutenant Clark, it sounds like a big part of stopping this is going to be something that I know the State Patrol and every police agency is already working on, trying to crack down on impaired driving. What kind of measures do you think might help there?
Well, you know, when I started on the State Patrol, we talked about the three E's of highway safety, and that is, of course, enforcement, engineering, and also education as well. So reaching out to the media, And identifying this being a significant problem that's occurring throughout the state of Wisconsin, so that hopefully we can educate motorists out there of the issue and hopefully get some people to take the own initiative not to drive impaired and intoxicated and endanger themselves or others. But from an enforcement perspective, again, we are looking at those hotspot locations so that we can increase saturation patrols throughout the year in an attempt to interdict those motorists and correct that behavior.
Now, you mentioned some of these efforts focused on Milwaukee County, Dane County, Brown County, I believe are three most populated counties, so that makes sense. But is this a problem we see elsewhere in the state in our less urban counties as well?
Well, the data that's coming in is only preliminary, and a lot of it, as we adjust or analyze the data, may be based on the voluntariness of those local law enforcement agencies and their reporting mechanisms to the Traffic Management Center. But for example, in Shawano County, just this year alone, we've identified 28 incidents of wrong-way driving on the state highway system. So that was one that jumped off the page for me and has been flagged for the safety engineers in that region with our Department of Transportation partners to have a look at the state highway system in Shawano County and see whether we have an engineering problem that we need to address as well.
That's been a while since I had driver's ed, Lieutenant Clark, but is there advice for people who are driving the right way down a highway and they see all of a sudden this wrong way driver coming in their direction?
Yeah, we can't give, 100% advice, but statistically, 90% of the motorists that we've identified that are driving the wrong way on a divided highway are typically located or driving in what we call lane one, or the left hand, if you're operating in the right direction, the left hand lane. That's because they believe in their intoxicated or impaired state that they're in the right lane of the direction that they think is traveling. So what we do is when we do detect wrong way drivers, we use our DMS boards or our overhead message signs to alert motorists that are traveling in the right direction that they should be prepared to take evasive action. So what my recommendation is, if you do see a motorist coming at you the wrong way, move over to the right, slow down, and be prepared to take that evasive action so you can avoid a head-on collision. Notify us via 911 so that we can get emergency vehicles out there to respond to that violator, and hopefully we can interdict them before they cause a significant crash.
As we wrap up, Lieutenant Clark, I don't know if other states are keeping this kind of data. Do we know if Wisconsin is particularly bad when it comes to wrong-way driving?
We don't have that data available to us right now. As I said, this is something that really just kind of came to our attention originating in Milwaukee County, and we're now starting to study statewide. I do know that according to the data, Wisconsin is one of the top five states, unfortunately, in the number of impaired drivers operating on our system. And so given the fact that 86% of these wrong-way driver incidents are have a impaired driver contribution, if you will, then you can probably speculate that we do actually have a higher than normal number of wrong-way drivers. So it's something that the state is aware of and taking the steps that we can hopefully counteract that.
Lieutenant Clark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Lieutenant Nathan Clark is with the Wisconsin State Patrol and the executive officer in charge of the Traffic Management Center. He joined us today to talk about the problem of people driving the wrong way down highways here in the state, the danger these mishaps cause motorists, and how the patrol and other agencies are trying to put a handle on that. Now let me tell you about a Wisconsin Public Radio mystery. A sack of potatoes appeared this week in Buck's studio where I am now. Where did these potatoes come from? I did some digging around. It turns out it came from the WPR old-time radio drama production, There's Always a Woman, live last weekend in Minocqua. WPR's own and Minocqua's own Michelle Good was in that production. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Rob.
Okay, you had these potatoes.
Yes,
I'm holding them in my hand right now.
Mm-hmm. I like that you said digging them
for
up.
For the potatoes, yeah.
That's clever.
But what did you need potatoes for in this live radio drama?
Well, the potatoes are the Foley sound for a dead body hitting the ground.
All right, so there's a murder.
There's a murder, yes.
Okay.
So there's a gunshot, then the potatoes are the sound of the body falling,
okay.
And then the women, who I'm all the women, so I scream.
There's always all the women, and it's Michelle Good.
Yes.
All right, now we're going to do a dramatic reenactment here. Do we have the potato hot mic on? Okay, we do. We got the thumbs up on
Excellent.
Here. So you says a gunshot.
Gunshot.
Body.
Body.
Scream.
Scream.
Okay, here we go. Ready?
You have to do the gunshot.
I'm going to do the gunshot. Bang! Whoa, that was a heck of a scream. Did the potatoes really come through the body? Okay, you know, this is... There we go.
I think you're supposed to drop them so they don't all fall in a lump.
So, oh, so it's kind of
like the leg.
All right, one more try.
The
one
leg
more try
potato.
Before we... There we go. All right. That's Quality Radio. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.